other public matter, we can go. Everyone else is okay.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
House Committee on Revenue for February 14th, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we have three items of business today, two information meetings and one work session. We have four bills to introduce, but we'll wait, see if we get a larger committee before we do that. So let's start with the lottery overview, and I guess, Paul, you want to introduce that? And
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have been working through your basic facts document, and there's a section in there about lottery, but what we did was ask the lottery director to come, Barry Pack, has agreed to come and kind of brief the committee on an overview of the lottery and some of the issues that we're looking at over the next couple of years.
Great. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Barry Pack, director of the Oregon Lottery, and thank you for the chance to come and give you this overview of the lottery and its current operations and where we're headed in the future. For those of you who've been in the building for a while, I apologize at the remedial slides that may be in here, and for those of you who are new, I hope you have a chance to learn a few things about a really good organization. I want to start with our mission. This is an encapsulation of the statutory charge given to the lottery. It's our working, operating mission to operate a lottery with the highest standards of integrity and security to earn maximum profits for the people of Oregon commensurate with the public good. And I like to start with this because it's important to understand the interesting balancing act that the lottery goes through. We are a large revenue-generating organization. We bring in a lot of money for important state programs. And we do it through a product that comes with some risk for some people with addiction. And so every day when I get up and I come into the office, I think about this mission of maximizing profits commensurate with the public good. And we'll talk more about it in a few slides. But for the lottery, commensurate with public good means several things. It means the public good that the programs do, that our dollars help support, and the benefit Oregonians get from those, as well as our direct responsibility to minimize the negative impact of gambling on Oregonians. Here's a brief history of the lottery, and I won't go through each step other than to hit a couple of highlights, which is that voters created the lottery in 1984 by citizen initiative, simultaneously prohibiting the operation of any other casinos in the state, save for those operated by tribes under federal regulation and in compact with the state. And then throughout the course of the next three decades, voters have continued to express their opinions about where our funds should be dedicated and to which programs: education, parks, salmon, fish and wildlife, economic development, and most recently, veteran services and outdoor schools. We offer two principal products in our portfolio, what we call traditional product, which is our draw and instant games, so scratch tickets, Powerball, Mega Millions, Oregon's Game, Mega Bucks, those sorts of games, as well as Keno and a few others. There are about 1,700 lottery retailers that sell traditional products across the state. You've got to be 18 years old to play. And that in fiscal year 2016, we operate on an annual budget, July 1 through June 30. So in fiscal year 16, our traditional sales brought in $353 million in revenue. And you can see there the top three games Oregonians play. Our other major product, of course, is video lottery. And this is where the bulk of our revenues come from. 71% of our revenues are generated through video lottery sales. We sell in a combination of what we call on-premise and off-premise locations. So if you are you have an on-premise liquor license with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, you can sell video product. If you are off-premise, you don't have that license, you can only sell traditional product. If you have that license, you can sell video and traditional. So we have a mix of retailers who do that. you have to be 21 years of old to play. Those retailers must have age-restricted areas and site barriers for the machines to try and minimize youth exposure and activity there. We offer three types of games on our terminals, video poker, line games, which is the kind that you might be familiar with from casinos, and we recently launched a video Keno game. As I said, this is the larger source of revenue in fiscal year 2016, over $876 million in revenue. Just a quick snapshot of our players. I apologize, this graphic is really hard to see on screen or on paper, but generally speaking, the story here is that our players, particularly, and these are our video lottery players, the majority of our players, generally represent the demographic population of Oregon. There are some differences, some variances, but generally speaking, Oregonians are our players. So there's no big outstanding demographic difference. Quick snapshot of our retailers. Again, 70% of our revenue comes from video lottery retailers. You can see the lighter blue columns are on-premise retailers, so these are those that can offer video lottery. The darker blue are those that are selling traditional products only. 77% of our video lottery retailers are located in major metropolitan areas, almost half of them in the Portland area. And that will become important in a few slides as we look at what's happening today. This next slide is a snapshot of our growth over time. From the very beginning, back in 1985, when the lottery offered only scratch-it product, we were bringing in $32 million in a fiscal year. Over time, we've added more games, taken some away. Sports Action was added in 1990, came away in, I believe, 2005. And each time we introduced a new product, a new game, revenue grew. Up until in 2005, we introduced line games, and our growth spiked to over $1.2 billion. We've had three or four consecutive years of over $1 billion sales, and up until then, the economic downturn, well, two things happened, actually. In 2007, the legislature approved a ban on smoking in bars and taverns, and that had a pretty dramatic impact on our sales. Simultaneously, or a year later, the Great Recession hit, and the understanding had always been that lottery revenues were generally recession-proof, and the Great Recession proved that to not be true. We took a big hit in revenue. With the turnaround of the economy and some new terminals that we're introducing to retailers, our revenues are growing again. In unadjusted figures, our revenues are approaching where they were pre-smoking ban, pre-Great Recession. If you adjust for inflation, our revenues are 18% below their peak in 2007. This is just a quick graphic on where the money goes and how it flows. So our sales, our gross proceeds, are deposited with the state treasury. We pay prizes and expenses. We operate on about 3% administrative expense. We're allowed by law up to 16%. So after we pay prizes and our costs, we transfer those net proceeds then to DAS. Those then become, they're called unobligated net lottery proceeds. And then DAS pays debt service on our on lottery-backed revenue bonds, replenishes any reserves that are required for those bonds, distributes the funds to the beneficiaries as in directed in the Constitution or in statute, and the rest then goes to the legislature to allocate to the various programs that are within your discretion under education and economic development. We also transfer 1%, not 1%, $12 million, yeah, 1%, $12 million to pay for gambling treatment in Oregon. Quick snapshot of our past beneficiary allocations. We transferred $1.2 billion in the 15-17 biennium. You'll see how that was distributed to the four major areas. Historically, the lotteries contributed over $11 billion to state programs. And you can see, again, there, $6.7 billion to education, $2.9 to economic development, $1.2 to parks and natural resources, and $92 million for gambling addiction treatment. The graphic on the side is from the Office of Economic Analysis. That's their forecast for the outlying biennia for lottery revenues, and you'll see they're continuing to show some growth there, and the distributions as veteran services and outdoor schools get added into the mix starting next biennium. Wanted to talk just a few minutes about our corporate social responsibility. This is a piece of our doing business commensurate with the public good. I recently promoted a staff person who was responsible for running our responsible gambling and problem gambling program into a new position, director of corporate social responsibility, to augment the importance of that role within the organization. Again, it's that balance between maximizing profits and minimizing harm. We are one of four states that went through the first initial certification with a partnership with the National Association, the National Conference of Problem Gambling, and the National the North American Association of State and Provincial Lotteries. Sorry, those acronyms get a little tongue-tying at times. They partnered to offer a certification of state lottery responsible gambling programs. We were proud to be one of the first four certified and the only lottery that's operating video lottery to get that certification. We've also been recognized by the National Council for our corporate social responsibility work. And we have a very strong and, I would say, unique partnership with our prevention and treatment providers in the state, as well as privately run treatment centers and the advocacy community. We meet quite regularly, and while we can't always see eye to eye, we agree to disagree respectfully and recognize that we get a lot more working together than we do working against each other. So I'm particularly pleased to see this work. When I was shortly on the job, I went to the National Council on Problem Gambling annual conference. I think I was the only lottery director to go, but I felt it was important to demonstrate the commitment that Oregon has to this program. We're in a unique place in that we pay for, the lottery pays for treatment, so gambling addiction treatment is free in Oregon, and that has given us, I think, a huge leg up that many other states have some envy over. Where we're headed, we've been monetizing our video lottery program, and I'll talk about that in the next slide. We need to continue to keep pace with technology and with the marketplace and our traditional system that runs our scratch and draw games is due for replacement in a few years as well. Like many state agencies that are over 30 years old now, we have internal business operating systems that are at end of life and unsupportable that need to be replaced. We're taking this opportunity to look across the entire organization and figure out ways to leverage our systems and our work processes and our data to get more efficient and to maximize our profits. We're building out our corporate social responsibility program. We're working to develop and execute a responsible revenue strategy to counter some of the market pressures that I'll talk about in a few minutes. And when I say a responsible revenue strategy, that means not asking our current players to play more or wager higher, but to find new markets and new distribution channels to reach some new players. Over the last 5 years, we've been running a pretty comprehensive video lottery terminal modernization program. We've deployed over 7,600 new terminals across the state. There's 12,000 total planned that need replacement and upgrade. Again, most of these are 6-7 years old and need replacement. With current technology, we have 95% of our retail locations are ready to convert to a new gaming platform that we launched in September. That will do many things, but principally one that we're most looking forward to is we'll be able to push game sets to retailers centrally from our headquarters in Salem. Right now, if we want to introduce a new game to a terminal, we send a technician out to every location with a thumb drive who has to touch every machine to load the game. With the new system, we'll be able to push them out electronically. That will let us do a lot of things. We can segment our market better. We can target games in areas of the state that are more preferred by players there. If there's something that's playing differently in an urban environment than a rural, we can move away from a one-size-fits-all approach and target a little bit better. We've converted the network and are mostly through with that. I'm very proud to say we launched the new operating system in September of last year. You saw no press about it because it went well. And we're continuing to move forward to our field test and full implementation. There are a couple of environmental issues out there that I wanted to bring to your attention, the first being market pressures, competition with tribal casinos in Oregon and Washington. You may be hearing about the Alani Resort in La Center, which is 20 miles north of Portland. It's going to be a massive casino run by the Cowlitz tribe. The Office of Economic Analysis is forecasting some fairly significant reductions in our revenue as a result of operating that. I know the tribes are also, the tribes in Oregon are also very concerned about what that impact might do to their revenue. The Coquille tribe down in southern Oregon is working on being able to open a gaming center in Jackson County. Grand Ronde continues to express interest in redeveloping their Wood Village location. They describe it as a family entertainment center with some gambling, but no specifics around what that gambling would look like. And there's been some recent renewed interest by two private business owners who attempted to pass ballot measures in the past allowing for the operation of a private casino. They've indicated interest in returning to the ballot in 2018, although we've seen no specific proposal on that. So we're keeping an eye on that. I mentioned earlier that almost 50% of our video retailers are in the Portland metropolitan area, and we're starting to see some pressure from real estate prices in Portland. What we're seeing is longtime neighborhood bars and taverns are being sold because of the skyrocketing retail prices. They're being torn down and redeveloped as mixed-use condominiums and retail facilities. That's good for urban development, but those retail locations tend to be smaller footprints. They can't accommodate the footprint requirements of video lottery terminals, and so we're losing lottery retailers in the urban core. What we're seeing is a reduction in the urban core, some growth in the suburbs, so retailers are moving out to the suburbs. But that has an impact, a potential impact on our sales. We've also done some analysis around market saturation, looking at nationally recognized standards for gambling. If you look at total gaming in Oregon, so including Oregon Lottery and tribal casinos to the best of our ability to judge because we don't have full information from all of the tribes around their operations. But if you include all gaming in Oregon, we're pretty much at market saturation. If you don't include tribal casinos, there's a little bit of room for growth from the lottery in terms of our current operations. But what this really tells me is any future growth is going to have to come from new product offerings. It's not just by bringing in more retailers or being able to tap players for our current product offerings. So all of this raises a lot of questions about where our revenues will go in the future when the casinos open or these market pressures continue to grow. So we've done a little bit of analysis that basically reinforces the fact that we just don't know what's going to happen. One of the things that we have found is that our players don't play necessarily where they live. So they're not necessarily coming home from work and going to their neighborhood bar or tavern to have dinner and play some video lottery. They're playing on their way to work. They're playing on their lunch hour. They're playing on their way home from work. So there's a lot, especially in the Portland metropolitan area, including Clark County, there is a lot of migration during the workday back and forth, and play continues throughout that. And then we looked at Washington players, and interestingly enough, the closer you get to the border and a bridge, the more likely video lottery players are going to be Washingtonians. If you look at Hayden Island right there at the I-5 junction, 84% of their players are from Washington. We know that by looking at the license plates in the parking lot, but we also know it by the payment of jackpot prizes where players have to come to our facilities to claim their prize. We get an address so we know where they live. Mr. Chair, I think there's a question.
Oh, Representative Nose, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do they not have video poker in the state of Washington?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, they do not. The only video gaming is on tribal casinos in Washington State.
Sales tax revenge.
We need another bridge.
Maybe we do.
Amen.
If you look at the map on the right, the other interesting thing that I would note is the commute shed down I-5 and I-205. As you look down there, you'll see there are plenty of census tracts where 25, 30, 40% of players are from Washington. So again, this reinforces the question that, or the fact that, our players are playing on their commute. And so what that means is we don't really know whether that's going to stop when Ilani opens. Will they stop playing on their lunch hour? Will they brave the traffic going across the river and go even further up to La Center? Certainly on a weekend, they will. You know, there's a different market for destination casinos than there are for video lottery play. So just to know that we're watching it, we're keeping an eye on what's happening. We'll work hard with our retailers to continue to promote their sales and their businesses, because if sales drop for them, it not only hurts our revenues, but it hurts their local economies and their own income. And we primarily do that through promotions, where we promote both our products and our beneficiaries. We do pop-up events at retail locations. We do point-of-purchase display materials and advertising to help draw sales to our retailers and to our products. I want to just wrap up here with a little bit about our beneficiaries and our brand. Largely, our brand, the lottery's brand, is the retailers, the beneficiaries. Where the money goes is a prime reason for Oregonians to be supportive of the lottery. And our research shows that 65% of adult Oregonians have a positive opinion about the lottery, and most of those are because of how the dollars are spent. If asked to feel how they feel about what lottery dollars do for Oregon, 72% are positive. And 91% of adult Oregonians can correctly identify at least one of the beneficiaries. And one in three can identify all four. I think that's a testament to our ability to get out to the public the information about what lottery revenues help support in Oregon. And to that end, I wanted to just show a couple of quick television spots that we've produced to highlight our beneficiaries. This first one, we produced last year. It was our 30th anniversary. So we produced, a pretty wonderful spot.
The people of Oregon created our lottery to make the state we love an even better place to live, work, and play. And over the past 30 years, that's meant billions of dollars for supporting public schools, for growing Oregon's economy, for maintaining state parks, and enhancing vital watersheds, keeping our heart in all the right places.
I'm coming home to the place that I remember. Back to the land of my first love. Would you spread wide your arms for this wayward son? I left my heart in Oregon.
Lottery games are based on chance and should be played for entertainment only.
And this second spot is what's currently running on TV right now.
Oregon is an inspiration. Whether you come to it or are born to it, you become entranced by our state's beauty, the opportunity she affords, and the independent spirit of her citizens.
Thanks to you. $10 billion of lottery funds for schools, parks, jobs, fish, and wildlife help make Oregon our Oregon. Lottery games are based on chance and should be played for entertainment only.
So while we're running these television spots advertising our beneficiaries, we're also advertising our product, of course, and we're also always advertising responsible gambling and problem gambling awareness. So we have a spot out right now called Boater, which features a gentleman in a boat on a lake fishing. And the water's spilling up, and he's denying that he needs any help to solve that. And so we try to connect people to treatment through television advertising as well as digital advertising as well. So that is my overview, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
What Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Barry. Excellent presentation. I have two questions, and I was just asking Paul this, but I really am going to ask. The tagline at the end at should be played for entertainment, didn't that used to be should not be played for investment purposes? And does it go back and forth?
Yeah, or? Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, there are different requirements in statute for different advertising. So as I recall, the non-investment purposes is for product advertising, and our beneficiary advertising is what you saw here.
Okay, interesting. Thank you. And follow-up?
Please.
Okay. And then I do feel obliged to channel some of my predecessors and ask about the reimbursement rate for kind of a little information about where that is now, where it's been, and just kind of let you comment on that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, I think you're asking about commissions to retailers.
Yes.
So we the current commission rate was established as part of the last contract that went out to all retailers. All of our retail contracts renew at the same time for some crazy reason, because I think that must be a lot of work. I haven't gone through that yet. Our contracts renew in 2020, so that'll be the next opportunity to revisit the commission rate. For video lottery, where the most of the money comes, we have a two-tiered rate system. Retailers get to choose at the start of a fiscal year which rate they want to receive commissions under. It's a tiered rate based on sales. Sort of unique to Oregon, we'd like to do things uniquely here. The higher the sales go up, the lower the commission rate goes. Normally in a commission setting in a business, the more you sell, the more commission you make. In this case, it's the reverse. So that's a discussion we'll have with our retailers in the next couple of years.
Interesting.
Representative Vance? Oh, I'm sorry. Other people ahead of you.
Like, no, I'm not. I'm behind Representative.
Okay.
We all are.
All right.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the income spread, and it looked as though half the folks gambling have incomes less than $40,000. But I also noticed that we have a 25% rate of non-disclosure as who it is that's actually giving us their money. If we were to allocate a quarter of that undisclosed, it would look like almost half the people that we take this money from have incomes of less than $40,000. So it would look like this is a regressive tax at its heart. And this is an old conversation we've had many times here in this
yeah.
room. I guess the question is, it doesn't look like it has changed. I think you show us, I don't know how many years this shows us, but it looks as though we can anticipate if we continue this effort, this device will consistently be taking half of lottery from people that are under 40,000 income. Is that pretty much a norm across the United States? And have we got it right?
Representative Barnhart, Representative Benz, I think the way you've characterized an allocation of unknown players is legitimate. There are probably other ways that could be. You know, we just don't know. I don't know that I have a lot of data nationally. I don't believe that Oregon, though, is out of sync with other states that offer video product. There's not most states do not offer video, so we're one of, I think, 14 states that offer video. So there's not a lot to go from. We're more similar to Canadian lotteries than we are to any other lottery in Oregon. I would say the demographic changes slightly. Our average player is a little couple years younger than they were a few years ago. We're seeing more women play than historically over time. But we're not talking about big shifts. We're not talking about anything that's just statistically significant. I think the piece you touched on at the end there is our core players are aging. And the next generation of players aren't necessarily attracted to our current product offering. They're looking for skill-based games. They're looking to play on their mobile devices. And so I think one of the future revenue risks is how do we stay current with the player base and how do we reach out across broader demographics to attract a different set of players than what may be playing now. The other thing that I will say is, you know, we have anonymous play in Oregon. We don't know who's playing. In some Canadian provinces, they've moved to player accounts where you register and you can have, you know, just like you would on anything you do online any longer. And then the lottery knows who you are and what you're playing. There's some benefit to that from the responsible gambling perspective because you can offer a lot more valuable tools like self-exclusion, budget tools, time tools, where you can enter in what your budget is for the night or how long you're willing to you want to play, what your goal is, and then the system can tell you, you know, hey, you've reached your nightly budget. Do you want to stop playing now, or can it actually shut down? So there's some benefits to that. There's, you know, some cons to it as well. But that would be one way to get a better sense of who's actually playing.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
So, do we use any of the money that we invest here to educate high school kids not to gamble?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, we aren't currently. I think there's a lot of sensitivity about exposing, you know, there's the argument that says teach kids the challenges and the risks of gambling also exposes them to gambling. And so I think there's been sort of a sensitivity about not wanting to introduce that concept to kids. I think high school kids are pretty well aware of gambling that's going on there. I'm sure they're doing their March Madness pools as well. I think there's some pros and cons there, but we're not doing anything at this point in time.
Well, I didn't hear that we're not investing in high schools now, any of this money to educate kids that we're not doing that is what I'm hearing.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
I think I had some at this end. Representative Marsh?
Yeah, I'm wondering, you may or may not have the answer to this, but we'll find out. On the gambling addiction treatment, do you know if the money that we're investing into those programs right now is able to take care of the demand? Are people on waiting lists?
Chair Bernhardt, Representative Marsh, there are no long waiting lists that I'm aware of. One of the most important things in any sort of treatment setting is when someone who's having a problem is ready for help and reaches out, you've got to be there for them at that moment. Any delay and they'll fall back into their destructive behavior. So we hear anecdotes here and there, but by and large, our partners in the prevention community are handling the demand as it is.
Okay. Thank you.
I would, if I can, just
please,
one
yeah.
quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to note, I learned recently in taking this job that here in Salem, Bridgeway Recovery Services is the only residential treatment program for gambling addiction west of the Mississippi. Mm. So we have a pretty special partnership there.
While we're on that topic, have you mentioned the hotline?
I have not mentioned the hotline, but there is a hotline. We promote that in our responsible and problem gambling advertising. It's a triage hotline. You call and they can connect you to a counselor right away if you're in crisis or can provide information about treatment opportunities.
And there are a number of outpatient treatment programs around the state, aren't there, that the commission pays for?
Yes, $12 million biannually.
Yeah.
And I also would be remiss in not mentioning that we recently launched a responsible gambling training program for workers at our retail locations. We've had over 1,000 workers go through the program. It's not a training on how to get someone to stop gambling, but it's how to recognize the signs and how to have the conversation that there are resources available. So it's been a great partnership with our retailers, and we're continuing to roll it out across the network. And all of our staff have taken the training as well.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For every dollar that comes in, what percentage is paid out? I apologize. You may have shared that earlier. I was out of the room.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's a complicated answer because it depends on the game.
On average,
video lottery games pay out 92 to 94% of the time.
Okay. So are those rates statutorily set, or are they set by a management system?
They're set by what best practice in the gambling industry is. The games appeal to different types of players. There are games that pay out less frequently but pay out at a higher level. And those appeal to our core players. Our light players, those who are playing, you know, once a month or maybe once a week, they like games that have more regular payouts, even if the amounts are smaller. They like bonus rounds. They like, you know, multipliers. They like that kind of excitement. They're not so focused on how much they're winning.
And so those best practices is what keeps the Oregon Lottery at optimal performance.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes.
Well, let me ask this question. During times of budget shortfall, what if you went from optimal to an A performance and you said rather than 97% payout, we're just going to move it to 96% payout? What would be the long-term effect on the lottery?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not sure I have the answer to that question. I'll turn back to my experts back at the headquarters and get back to you. We exist in a competitive marketplace. So if we're paying out more or less than our competitors, there's an impact to be felt.
Mr. Chair, I'm not talking long term. Just for a biennium, if you went from 97 to 96%. Payout, what would be the detrimental effects to the lottery long term?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Representative Smith, I'll have to get back to you on that. I want to make sure I give you an accurate answer.
And that's fair. I wouldn't expect an answer here, but you can see where I'm going with
this.
Yeah,
I understand. Yes.
I think that'd be interesting for this committee as a revenue committee to understand what a 0.5% could generate, but it's also important to understand the opportunity cost that affects the lottery on that as well.
And I will just say that we'll get back to you.
Please.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your report. So what's the process that the commission uses in determining what level of resources to invest in treatment and programs and so forth to help folks who would suffer from addiction-type behaviors? It's not a fixed percentage of your budget, I'm guessing. It sounds like it's kind of as needed, but how do you know you're devoting enough, I guess, to, you know, meet the needs of our population?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, statutorily, 1% of our revenues are directed to treatment. In terms of our discretionary resources, that's primarily around outreach and advertising. And that's a management practice, a management call. The commission approves our overall budget, and we direct those dollars. We believe very strongly in supporting our responsible gambling advertising. At any given time, we've got more points behind responsible and problem gambling than we do any product advertising. So we look hard to balance those resources. We also track the hotline calls and clicks to the Oregon Problem Gambling Resource website, and track, follow those from clicks, repeat clicks, to treatment, so we know whether people are actually taking action on it.
Okay, great, thank you.
I think Representative Bueller had a question, did you?
To follow up on Representative Smith's question, have those rates been changed over time in the past, where you have some history that you can do that analysis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, I'll have to get back to you on that again. I've only been here for about 9 months, so there are gaps in my knowledge.
Yeah, okay. I'd be interested in seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Smith,
did you have another one?
Yeah, that's fine.
I would just share with the committee, professionally, I do economic development for a living, and every once in a while I work with small business owners who work with the Oregon Lottery. And, Director, I have to share, you've been excellent to work with. Appreciate your leadership and appreciate the communication you've had with me.
Yes, thank you.
Great. Any other questions? Thank you very much. That was a great and colorful presentation. Enjoyed it very much.
Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. And with that, we will move on then to our business tax reform piece. Okay. Paul, do you want to introduce that?
If I could, Mr. Chair, just to follow up on the lottery
presentation. Oh, please. We'll do that first.
We will have an update from the Office of Economic Analysis next Wednesday. They work with the lottery. They've gone through their review of the updated forecast, and the forecast will be out Wednesday, next Wednesday, the 22nd, and it'll be held in this room in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee meeting, and you are all invited to that meeting. So we'll have your nameplate here at the dais and everything if you want to come to that meeting.
And that's what time?
It's at 8:30 next Wednesday morning. So it'll be the general fund revenue forecast and the update on the lottery.
All right. For new members, this is a routine meeting that we hold approximately once a quarter. Because of the timing of it and which committee meets in which part of the day, will be sitting with the Senate committee to receive the report. I don't know. They may have some other business to do after that, at which point, of course, you're excused. But it's a very useful exercise for members to be aware of the revenue estimate as it comes in. And if we need to, we can give some a further orientation to it at another time. Paul, do you want to go ahead with the with the next
Mr. Chair, we do have four LCs if you'd like to,
we do.
Introduce those. Those are four committee LCs that are in OLS.
All right. Well, thank you. And with that, we'll open a work session on bill introduction. As always, I will say that, that it's been the custom of the committee since Representative Lane Shetterly was chair of the committee to introduce committee bills as a courtesy to get bills into the proper. Voting in favor of the motion to introduce committee bills does not indicate that the member has any particular position on the bills being introduced. Representative Bentz.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills: LC 2513, dated 11/29/16; LC 3340, dated 2/10/17; LC 3759, dated 1/26/17; and LC 3792, dated February 13th, 17.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves that LCs 2513, 3340, 3759, and 3792 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Yes, Representative Buehler.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I'll be voting no. I personally have great difficulty with these committee bills. I think it puts us at risk for not being consistent with transparency and accountability.
Thank you very much. So with that, are there any other objections to the motion?
Is it possible, Mr. Chair, to get a brief summary of the relating clause of these
measures?
Sure,
absolutely. Comes under discussion. Let's see. I'm not sure I've got them in the same order, but 3340 has a related clause relating to corporate tax disclosure. Well, there's a disclosure bill. 2513 is relating to depreciation of assets, having to do with Section 168 of the Internal Revenue Code and related topics. LC 3792 is relating to taxation of certain heavy equipment, and it has to do with property taxation. It's a fairly long bill. I can't tell you any more about it than that because I don't know any more about it than that. And the last bill is relating to tax credits for biomass. Any other questions? Thank you. Any other discussion? Other than the objection we've already heard from Representative Buehler, are there any other objections? Representative Johnson? All right. So with those two no votes, I assume that everyone else votes yes, and if I don't hear an objection, I'll assume that. And with that, the motion carries. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on introduction of committee bills and move on then to the business tax reform continuation of yesterday's discussion. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We, as you've looked on the agenda for the week, we have each day we have a segment of discussion around the business tax reform. Yesterday, we tried to take a really broad view of what other states do in terms of broad general business taxes. One of the areas where we focused on was corporate income taxes, and of course, that's the general business tax that Oregon uses. And so Chris has put together some slides for you to get a better handle on how our current system works and the kind of issues that each a state has to grapple with when they're imposing a corporate income tax at the state level. And he's got what he calls a painful yet simple example that he's going to work through with you.
Okay. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm afraid this presentation will not be nearly as colorful or entertaining as the prior one. So just taking it from there, in line with everything that Paul just described, I just wanted to set some context here for what, because this is going to drill down very much into the weeds of the C corporation tax and a lot of the issues and terminology you've heard around that. So just for some context, the business income taxation in Oregon. We have the personal income tax, and sole proprietors pay through that. Those are Schedule C and F. We have about 275,000 of those filers, and in 2014, they paid about $200 million in income tax. And then we have pass-through entities, about 120,000 of those, and they paid about $475 million in tax in 2014. And, of course, these pass-through entities are the partnerships as corporations, LLCs, those kinds of things. The other big piece is the corporate income tax, and this is the S-corporations and the C-corporations. The S-corporations, we have about 60,000 of those, and they paid $10 million here. This is the just the minimum tax piece for the S-corporations. They show up in here. That's where the majority of their tax gets paid. For C-corporations, we have about 30,000 of them, and in 2014, they paid about $510 million in tax. And then to drill down further, we have Oregon-only corporations. And for these corporations, all the issues that we're going to be getting into are not issues. They only operate in Oregon. So we're talking about things like nexus, unitary, business, non-business, and apportionment. Those are not an issue because they are solely located in and operated within the boundaries of Oregon. And there are about 15,000 of those, and they paid about $50 million in tax in 2014. And then we have multi-state tax returns. Now, just for some context, we have separate – some states use a separate filing method where every C corporation has to file its own return. And for those states, unitary is not an issue. Oregon is not one of those states. Oregon is a multi – we have multi-state combined consolidated returns. And so for these types of corporations, the issues pertain to nexus, unitary, business, non-business, and apportionment. Those are significant issues. And that's also the focus of this presentation. About 15,000 of these corporations, and they paid about $460 million in tax in 2014. So the point of this is to go through and to simplify. I'm going to attempt to simplify these issues and convey the policy choices. And in doing that, I just wanted to make the disclaimer that almost every point in here, there are points of contention between corporations and the state about how the issues play out. But I'm glossing over those to get across the main policy points. So the key terms and also the presentation here, I have about 10 slides, and they start to build on each other. So if it's okay with the chair, I would urge people to ask questions as they come up because they do build on each other. The key terms, we have nexus, which is just the connection to the state and the state's ability to tax a corporation. Unitary is a concept where a group of corporations are deemed to be one economic unit and get taxed and treated as though they were one business entity. Allocated income is income that a corporation earns, but it's not part of their day-to-day business. So that income is subject to taxation, but it gets allocated to the source of that income. So I have a couple of examples there. One example is capital gains income. Corporations have to be taxed on that, but that usually gets allocated to the headquarter state. And then the fourth issue here is apportionment income, and this is where a lot of the technical this is where things get really technical, and a lot of aspirin gets consumed. So we have the state is a single sales factor state, and one of the things to keep in mind is tangible versus intangible products. Those get handled differently. Joyce Finnegan has to do with determining which corporations are taxable. That's largely a tangible issue. And then we have cost of performance and market-based. That's an intangible or services issue. And then throwback sales and public law 86-272 are issues that will come up here. And I'm just trying to show you how they all connect to each other. So the example we have here is we have one C corporation taxpayer. And on their federal return, so they file a return, and it shows $88 million in U.S. sales and $13 million in taxable income, federal taxable income. That's the bottom line on the return. And so here's what the corporation looks like. We have Corporation A, located in Washington, and they manufacture furniture. And we have Corporation B, located in Oregon, and they manufacture cabinets. And then we have Corporation C, an interior design firm located in Idaho. So that's the core structure, if you will. And then there's this other entity, an LLC, owned by Corporation A, Baseball Bats LLC. Mm. And this is here to represent, I'm going to come back to that, it's about a unity issue. So the first thing that jumps out is Corp A and Corp B are businesses that produce tangible personal property. Corporation C provides a service. They're an intangible. So now we're going to get into some of the numbers that play out to show how these issues work themselves through. Corporation A has $30 million in sales. $21 million of them occur in Washington. They stay in state. This company is located in Washington. $9 million of their sales go to Oregon. Corporation B also has $30 million in sales. $12 million stays in Oregon, and $18 million goes to Washington. Now, a key assumption here, the way I've crafted the example, is that all of the export sales for these two companies, the only presence that each company has in the exporting state is solicitation of sales. There's no physical presence there, so Corporation A doesn't have any offices or any facilities in Oregon, and similarly, Corporation B doesn't have any facilities or operations in Washington. It's just the solicitation of sales.
Sure, of course, I know that, yeah.
Corporation C has a total of $20 million in sales, $7 million in Oregon, and $13 million in Idaho. Now, of the $7 million that are sold in Oregon, $2 million of them are actually performed in Oregon. So there's a contract where somebody from Corporation C went to Oregon and they produced that service within the borders of Oregon. So that's kind of the core structure for the three corporations. Two added pieces here just to explain some of those other terms. We have BBLLC. They have $5 million in sales and $2 million in income, but all that happens in Kentucky. So there's no connection to Oregon here. And Corporation A also has $3 million in sales and $1 million in income related to a rental property in Washington. So this is an example of non-business income, and the LLC is an example of the unitary issue. So working through those three, now here's that same diagram. I just carry this through. The first issue is nexus. Well, the way I've set this up, the corporation filed an Oregon return, so they believe they have some level of nexus and they owe some level of Oregon tax. As they filed, they argue that corporations A, B, and C are unitary. The LLC is not. So for Oregon purposes, and again, all of this is to determine how much tax Oregon can collect from this company, the $5 million in sales and the $2 million in income move off the table. It's a non-unitary, so Oregon is going to be focusing on these. This non-unitary business has no connection to Oregon because everything is in Kentucky. So that's off the plate, if you will. And then as an example of allocated income, we have the rental income. It's due to a property owned by Corporation A. This corporation is not in the business of rental properties. They're in the business of cabinets and furniture and interior design. So that income is taxable, but it's allocated to Washington. So that's off the table for Oregon. So while they have $88 million in U.S. sales and $13 million in taxable income, that $88 million in sales is reduced by $8 million. The $3 million from the rental property and the $5 million from the LLC. So their sales go from $88 million down to $80 million. And the income goes from $13 million down to $10 million. The $1 million from the rental property and the $2 million from the LLC are gone. So for Oregon purposes, those don't exist. So now this is the structure of
Representative Nose?
So I think I'm following it. The $10 million that doesn't count is just because it's solely Washington-based and we're even though I could argue maybe that it has some benefit to the Oregon part of the company because it's based in Washington and it's not their core to their business, we don't get to include it.
Right. This is part of the distinction. And there was one of the bills that you heard that modifies the definition of business income. It changes it from business income to apportioned income. And businesses have two kinds of income, allocated income, and that's deemed to be outside the day-to-day business of the company, so it's not subject to the apportionment. So Oregon can't tax that unless it's directly from an Oregon source.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Please, yes. Mm-hmm.
So if that was, instead of Washington in, under Corp A, that was Oregon, then the rental we would be able to tax because that's happening directly in our state.
Correct. That would be allocated to Oregon.
Okay.
Similarly, this business here, if they were located in Oregon instead of Kentucky, they would have to file an Oregon C corporation return. They wouldn't be part of this because they're not part of the unitary group. They would have to file a separate C corporation. So that this would be an example of an LLC filing a C corporation.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Please, yes.
Is this what you're explaining here? Is this how most of the states do it? I mean, I realize that everybody's got a sort of different, all 50 states have different tax structures, but in general, is California not taxing something that's exclusively happening in Oregon, even though you can clearly see there's some relationship?
I think Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose, at some level, the answer is yes, but the if you get down to the details, and it doesn't take long to get to the details, right, where that yes becomes a no, because it depends on how it gets played out.
Okay.
But the idea is you have a corporation that operates in multiple states, and every one of those states that it operates in gets to tax that income somehow. Okay, so for Oregon purposes, here's what the corporation looks like. We're just focusing on A, B, and C and their business income. So the starting point is federal taxable income is $10 million. So the question comes down to how much of that $10 million is Oregon allowed to tax? And that's where a lot of the complication really comes in. So how much can each of the three states tax? And Oregon uses the single sales factor, the share of Oregon sales that the share of U.S. sales that are attributable to Oregon. And this is where a lot of the confusion gets in. I'm going to be really careful to try and not say taxable sales because that confuses the issue. Because it really is just a method to determine how much of that $10 million in federal taxable income Oregon can tax. So the apportionment percentage, Oregon sales divided by U.S. sales, and the U.S. sales is $80 million. And then Oregon taxable income will be the FTI, the federal taxable income of $10 million, multiplied by this apportionment percentage. And so the question really becomes, or the task becomes, which of these sales among these three corporations go into the numerator? So all of the discussion, I have four more slides that go through four scenarios, and that's all of the discussion is which sales go into the numerator. So scenario one, and I carry this forward to each slide, that's that same icon, it doesn't change, and then these are just some of the key terms I'm going to touch on. So under current law, we are a JOIC state and a cost to performance state. So under a JOIC state, that means whether or not these sales go in the numerator has to be handled on a corporation-by-corporation basis. You have to look at Corporation A, and then Corporation B, and then Corporation C. So JOIC, or Corporation A, is not taxable in Oregon because the sale, while they make sales into Oregon, those sales are protected by public law 86272, which says that if it, for tangible personal property, if the only connection is sales into a state, the state can't tax them. And I'm going to be circling back to these time and time again. And the cost of performance says that as long as some services are performed in Oregon, then there's a nexus there, and the state can include that in the numerator of the sales, or numerator of the sales factor. So the formula here for determining Oregon sales is we have the sales that we get from A, B, and C. Now, Corporation A, as I stated, those sales, while $9 million in sales go to Oregon, Public Law 86272 says that we can't tax them, basically because Corporation A isn't really in the state. And this is under the JOIC method. And then Corporation B we look at and say, well, $12 million in sales occur in Oregon, so those go in the numerator, and that's right here. And then the $18 million of sales here that Corp B ships to Washington, are thrown back to Oregon, just as the $9 million in sales from Corp A to Oregon can't be taxed by Oregon, it goes the other way as well.
Okay.
So the $18 million in sales from Corp B into Washington are also protected by Public Law 86272. So those get thrown back to Oregon. And then for Corporation C, now we're switching gears because we're not talking about tangibles, we're talking about services. And we're a cost of performance state. So we look at all of their $7 million of sales in Oregon. And this is one, it's kind of a, the way this often gets talked about as we get into it is that corporations are subject to cost of performance. But it's really the sales within the corporation. So for example, this corporation had $7 million of sales in Oregon. $5 million of those sales, the designs were produced in Idaho, and then somebody clicked send, and they got sent to a customer in Oregon. The $2 million, somebody from the company in Idaho actually came to Oregon and sat down for a week or some period of time and performed the services in Oregon. So those, for those $2 million in sales, all of the cost of performance occurred in Oregon, so Oregon taxes all of, or gets to include all of those sales in the numerator, and that's the $2 million. So we sum those up, nothing from A because of throwback rules, and then Corporation B, we get all of Corporation B, the combination of throwback and public law, and then just $2 million from C. That totals $32 million. Divided by the $80 million for the U.S. sales, and that's an apportionment percentage of 40%. Multiply that by the $10 million of federal taxable income, and Oregon gets to tax $4 million. Okay, we're 25% of the way there.
Okay.
Scenario two, I'm going to change Joyce from the Joyce method to the Finnegan method. Everything else is the same. It's the same company, everything else. So the difference now is that under Finnegan, if one of these entities has nexus in Oregon, then all of them are considered taxable. So Corporation B, they're down the street. They're in Oregon. And so every member of that unitary group is taxable in Oregon. So what that means is that it's kind of an all-in or all-out situation. So the formula here, I mean, the arithmetic is a little bit different. But Corporation A now, those $9 million of sales from Corp A into Oregon are now part of the numerator because Corp A is considered taxable because of Finnegan. The if one is, all is. And so those sales are not thrown back to Washington because they're taxable in Oregon. Similarly, we go to Corp B. The $12 million stays taxable in Oregon because they incur in Oregon. But now the $18 million that get shipped to Washington and had been thrown back under the Joyce method may not be thrown back under the Finnegan method. So the only the $12 million in sales from Corporation B are included in the numerator. And then Corporation C, it's the same situation. That's the intangibles, and I haven't changed that yet. So that totals $23 million. Divided by 80 million, and the apportionment percentage is 28.75%, and then applied to the $10 million of taxable income, and we get just about $2.9 million that Oregon can tax.
Yes, Representative Smith Warren, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chris, for walking us so nice and slowly through this. So what you are doing is you are showing us four different ways that this can be calculated. Mm-hmm.
Correct. They're kind of bifurcated, tangible and intangible.
Right.
And for tangible, Joyce or Finnegan. And then for the intangible, cost of performance or market.
Okay. So on the Joyce and Finnegan, Joyce v. Finnegan angle, is that a decision that like Oregon does either Joyce or Finnegan?
Correct. It's a policy choice. The right. Before it is a Senate bill that switch. There's a Senate bill in Senate Finance and Revenue that has the language that would switch from Joyce to Finnegan.
Okay.
That bill's simple. It's a one-word change.
But Right now, we use Joyce.
We use Joyce.
That's really what I'm trying to get to.
Oh, yes.
Is right now, we use Joyce. This shows the difference between, right now we're showing, so the first slide was our current law. And now this is, if we switch from Joyce to Finnegan.
Correct.
This is what would happen. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't point that. There's a label right here on the other one. It said current law. This one says SB 28.
Gotcha.
I forgot to mention that.
Thank you. Okay. That's it.
Okay, so scenario three, now we're going to go back to Joyce, and this time we're going to deal with the intangibles, and we're going to switch from cost of performance to market. So the Joyce situation is the same, so that'll look familiar. We don't get to include any of Corporation A sales, and we include all of Corporation B sales. Again, just to reiterate, for Corporation A under Joyce, because Corporation A isn't taxable, all of their sales into Oregon get thrown back to Washington. And for Corporation B, it works the opposite way. Now, Corporation C, what we've talked about here, we're talking about services being taxed according to the market-based method. And this is the more intuitive approach, where if the sales are made in a state or if the services, the language changes a little bit. And the language I've used here is services are delivered into the state. So for the $20 million in sales of Corporation C, $7 million of them are delivered in Oregon. So now their contribution to the numerator is $7 million instead of $2 million. So we have the zero from A, all of the $30 million from B, and the $7 from C. And we have $37 million divided by $80 million, and we now have an apportionment percentage of 46%. Times $10 million is how much income Oregon can tax if we were to just switch, keep our current law of Joyce, but switch cost of performance to market. And the final scenario is switching both from Joyce to Finnegan and from cost of performance to market. And this scenario might be the most intuitive. So we have Oregon sales. We just have one number from each corporation. Corporation A, the $9 million of sales into Oregon are included in the numerator. For Corporation B, only the Oregon sales go into the numerator, the $12 million. And for Corporation C, the $7 million of sales that are delivered in Oregon go into that numerator. So the 9, 12, and 7, we get 28 million divided by 80 is 35%. And then that 35% is multiplied by the 10 million. So these are four different ways. And these are all, I mean, it very much is in the weeds of how the state determines how much of the federal pie it gets. And that's the important thing to remember, is either just different ways to determine how much of that federal income Oregon gets to tax.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have two, I think, brief additional questions. So one is just to go to the cost of performance versus market-based. The company self-reports on the cost of performance, right? And there are, I would assume, standards that they use to determine that? Or am I wrong?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith Warner, all of these, it's a voluntary tax system. Corporations file their tax returns and they submit them to the Department of Revenue. And they will fill out this information and report it to what they think is correct. And the Department of Revenue will audit returns. And then there could be discussions about the details. But all of these issues can be contentious. Unitary can be contentious because depending on the corporation situation, if you have, like that baseball bats, if that had been a loss, say the way I set it up here, they had $2 million of income. If it were $2 million, dollars in loss, then it would be to the company's benefit to say, no, they're part of our unitary group.
Right.
Okay. And so depending on the plus and minuses, where the pluses and minuses land, that's where a lot of the disagreement comes in. And I tried to choose something that was pretty obvious that it wasn't unitary, but I made some sort of connection through wood that maybe somebody would argue, no, it really is the same thing, that baseball bats are furniture. something. I don't know.
Lawyer.
But I could have chosen an example that was a lot less obvious.
Balloons. Where
they could
be.
I'm sorry?
Balloons. They could have made balloons.
Correct. I mean, it could. These issues do get complicated.
It wasn't obvious.
One more, briefly, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
my
please.
My second one. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So the point of that being, there's a lot of squishiness in this system. There's a lot of squishiness.
Yes, and even
it's not really a question, but
there's a lot of room for disagreement.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, squishiness is the technical term, you understand. And then the other thing I just want to say briefly, and you perhaps are coming to this, then once we figured out what our different apportionment rates are under these different scenarios, then there's still the whole whether then the corporation takes that and applies it against their taxable income versus their sales and pays one or the other.
The
am I remembering
I
that
think
right?
You're getting at the minimum tax.
Oh, okay. I think yes.
So the minimum
Sorry.
Tax. So for this corporation, they had $80 million. $80 million. Well, it goes into the Oregon sales, and depending on what their Oregon sales is, depending on the method here.
Okay.
Then we have that. It's a 12-step schedule. You basically look up the table. Where are your sales? Yeah. And then that's your minimum tax.
Right.
So that's as a backdrop. And that would be after all of the credits and so forth.
Okay. So this would be how they figure out what their tax rate is. And then if after credits it's zero, then they would go to the minimum sales.
Right. So in this example.
Or to the minimum tax.
Right. The one I'm here. So $3.5 million. That's subject to the two rates. So the first $1 million is taxed at 6.6%. And then the next $2.5 million is taxed at 7.6%. So you sum those up. I'm not even going to. It's whatever it is. And a few $100,000. And then that's their tax subject to the rates. They would compare that to the minimum tax. And they would pay the larger of the two.
The larger. Right. That's what I always. Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you, Chris. That was really interesting. I'm going to have to go back and study all these slides. But as an overall comment, there are winners and losers in any one of these scenarios, depending on how they play out for any individual business that's impacted. So as we go down the road of sort of making some of the choices as to what directions might be good for us, it seems like the next step is to say what criteria or what policies are we trying to affect by making one or the other, going down one or the others of these paths, correct?
Yes, and that gets at, I think, I'm sorry, were you done? Or?
I had made some notes as to what some of those obvious criteria might be, and I just wondered if you were going to lead us into that conversation at some point.
Well, one of the issues, it kind of ties back to the single sales factor. If we go back further, tying in with Rep Nosa's question, on how to determine how much of that federal income gets to be taxed by the states. If we go back further in history, the starting point was what was called a three-factor formula. So every corporation in a given state, you'd look at the property in the state, the payroll in the state, and the sales in the state.
Right.
And initially it was an equally weighted formula. You take those three percentages, you take the average, and then that's how that percentage was multiplied by the federal taxable income. So that method was used. States have gradually gone to a single sales factor, Oregon being one of them. So the policy implication there is that for taxing at least corporations, if not businesses, that the metric for determining their appropriate tax burden is their sales in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where this is relevant here is you have cost of performance and you have Joyce Finnegan, the throwback. Those sales may or may not be included. I mean, there may or may not, the Oregon sales may or may not be included in the method. For example, Joyce has the throwback. So the $18 million or the $9 million from Corporation A sold into Oregon isn't being taxed, but those are actually sales in Oregon. So one of the policy questions is whether or not that approach is consistent with a single sales factor policy. And same with cost of performance is another example. I mean, that's a little more extreme because under cost of performance, it's not even where the sales occur, it's where the costs were incurred. that get attributed there. Whereas if you go to a market-based, then that more closely aligns with the sales in the state. And that's what I was trying to get at here with scenario four being perhaps the most intuitive, in that these three numbers, the 9, the 12, and the 7, actually represent the sales that occurred in the border or within Oregon.
Okay. Representative Nose?
I think Representative Marsh asked my question.
Great. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just kind of a comment. First of all, Chris, this is awesome. Really well done. That's good stuff.
Thanks.
You know, if you set aside all the politics and you set aside the budget issues of the state, I can see where companies could get pretty darn frustrated if they're building their business plan, you know, using the scenario before us. They're building their business plan, they're implementing their business plan, mm-hmm. and based upon operating in this scenario, three states, one of those three states changes their policy on them. They could have significant effects on how they implement the remaining portion of their business activities. And then if you compound it, knowing that each state is always in this conversation and that model is always changing on them, I can see where they'd get pretty passionate. And again, I'm a budget guy. Folks, I'm the audience. I know the need for money. I get all that. But this is pretty realistic of what business owners are having to manage on a regular basis. Just an observation.
How do you plan out 10 years?
It does get very complicated. I didn't even talk about Washington's or Idaho's, and the examples are set up to convey the points.
Well, and it goes back to why certain business owners in the state wanted predictability mm-hmm. in tax policy long term. Mm-hmm. Well, just an observation.
That's a great point. Representative Hernandez, please.
Thank you for the presentation. My question goes, what's stopping, or is there any type of regulation for these companies to not go unitary? Like what I've noticed from this is if they wanted to go unitary, you know, they find something in common, whether that be wood, that they could potentially save money collectively on their tax burden. So is there anything that the state could do to prevent that from happening? If so, has that been a fact, or has that been a factor in our decision making?
Well, the notion of unitary, I think of it more of as a taxation concept, as opposed to businesses going unitary. I think what you're getting at there is that businesses choose to, it's a vertical integration kind of a thing. Maybe a little bit of horizontal, but it's, and there are a lot of other reasons why businesses would choose to organize that way or purchase other businesses if they can reap some other dynamic of Corporation A buying Corporation B. Unitary, I think of as more as determining how much of a company's footprint can be taxed by a given state. And where that really plays out is some states use a separate filing system where every one of these corporations, A, B, and C, would file their own return. There is no unitary concept that way. And combined and consolidated states like Oregon, it's the unitary concept. And that can work for and against a corporation. So if Corporation A, B, and C all had positive income, then it doesn't matter. But if Corporation A and Corporation B had positive income and Corporation C had negative income, then the unitary group, you have those losses offsetting some of the income. Whereas if they filed separate, then the company with loss, you don't get to pay more negative in tax. Once you hit zero, that's it. So the filing, the unitary, that concept, it's a principle that the states try to go by. And it can be contentious and is one of the issues that the department deals with all the time, and companies having one view of what's unitary versus the state perhaps having a different view of unitary. And I came up with an example that seemed fairly obvious that they're not unitary, but it can get pretty complicated. But the vertical integration kind of situation, I think companies will do that for other reasons. They could do that for some tax certainty. It could deal with nexus in a certain state. Corporations may choose to establish nexus or avoid nexus in different states. It's fairly easy to do that, and it may be to their advantage. But the integration, I think, is more of other economic and business reasons.
Thank you. All right. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, I just want to highlight the point that Representative Smith made about the predictability, not only taxes, but also the regulatory structure. What I hear over and over again from both small and large businesses is just tell us what it's going to be and keep it that way, because you build models, you invest, you hire people, and to keep on changing back and forth, especially markedly, causes lots of problems.
How long have we had the system in place now in general terms? How long have we had that system?
The single sales has been around since 2005, I think. Yeah.
So it's been 12 years. Okay. That's a partial answer to your your concern. Representative Vance, please.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask Chris to go back to his first slide, because I think I finally did figure out one part of this presentation. No, the one
terms.
Before that, in fact.
The terms?
The title. Keep going. Go back one. Right there. And that really fine print, it says for entertainment purposes only. And I suddenly realized it was for Chris's entertainment, not ours. Yeah. He's laughing at us.
I think that's great. To make the disclaimer that I did not devise this system.
That's what you say.
It's a theft from the lottery, isn't it?
That was coincidence.
Right.
Also not for investment purposes.
Right. Representative Mills.
I'll pass.
Thank you. I've reached the end of my list. Paul wants to talk.
I just want to make one comment. I can't pass up this opportunity. On Chris's scenario 4, or any of the scenarios, to tie back to the report you had last week and a bill you'll be looking at, the listed jurisdictions, the offshore tax haven jurisdictions, the way they fit in is in that federal taxable income number there at the top, the 10 million. So what we're saying by the law you passed in 2013 with these listed jurisdictions, you're saying there's any member of this unitary group that has an affiliate in one of these listed jurisdictions, then the income from that affiliate is added to your federal taxable income. So it doesn't change any of this stuff about apportionment. It just gives you more potential at the top line to apportion back to Oregon. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the justification there is that that income was misreported in the tax haven. It should have been reported in the U.S. I mean, that's the rationale. So just to see where that fits in with this general diagram.
So it's the general definition of income.
Yes, the federal tax, federal income.
Federal, and rather than water, how to apportion it among the states.
Right, water's edge, as they call it. Yeah.
Right. Or in this case, water's edge plus some countries.
Plus.
Right. Yeah. All right. Other questions on this piece? Have we reached the end of what we wanted to cover today?
I think so.
All right. We did it. You did it in 47 minutes. That's pretty good.
That's very helpful.
I wasn't expecting you to be able to do it that quickly. I'm going to ask you for a clear written in on text definition of Finnegan and Joyce.
Okay.
Because I just cannot keep them straight in my head. I'm going to have to memorize them.
We need a mnemonic.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it.
A glossary. I feel like I need
a
page glossary.
You could refer to the works of the artists involved if you wanted to, but probably I wouldn't get that either.
I guess on that note, I would leave you with the thought that Joyce is one by one. You have to look at each company one by one, and Finnegan, it's all or none. That's a grotesque simplification, but
right.
I'll get you something
rhymes.
More refined.
One by one, all or none.
Mm-hmm. Can you do a puppet show with that?
Interpretive dance.
All right.
Entertainment purposes.
This does give us some hints as to what might come in at the end session video. I assume the people who are keeping track of all this are also keeping track of the possibilities of this meeting
today. I don't think
today.
This makes it.
This probably doesn't make it. No, this is way too in the weeds.
They're always tracking the revenue here.
I bet not.
We're the only ones who love it.
Yeah. We've completed our you'll hear this phrase only a few times this year, I hope, but we have exhausted our agenda for today. And unless there's something else, the committee will be adjourned until tomorrow, 1 o'clock.
Wait, what day are we doing the 8:30 brief? Is it Wednesday or Tuesday? Next Wednesday?
A week from tomorrow.
A week from tomorrow. It's February 22nd.
Not tomorrow. With that, we are adjourned.
Yeah.